Welcome to Reform Media Review. My name is Jared Oliphant. We have a great program lined up for you. This is a little bit of a crossover with Reform Media Review and Philosophy for Theologians. We'll have to see how it goes, how much depth we get into in this one. But I'm very excited to welcome our other contributor to this program, Nathan Shannon, who is actually in Seoul, Korea. That's a very international program today. Welcome to the program, Nate. It's great to have you.
Thanks, Jared. Good to talk to you.
As I mentioned, you're in Seoul, and I wanted to give you a little bit of an opportunity to explain why you're there, what you're doing there, some of the transitions that have been going on in your life, especially since receiving the PhD. There's been a lot of stuff going on in your neck of the woods. So if you would briefly explain, you know, you went over and defended your dissertation. Can you take us from that point to now and what you've been doing professionally?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Yeah, so that's, I went over to Amsterdam and defended my dissertation last fall, and almost immediately started to pack boxes to come to Korea. And immediately following that, you know, came back to the States and started to pack up, and we left for, well, it was sort of complicated, but we arrived in Korea early February, since because I took a position teaching systematic theology at a place called Torch Trinity Graduate University in Seoul. Torch is a seminary, and for reasons I'm only starting to understand, is called a graduate university. Has to do with the Ministry of Education, how they classify schools, something. Probably something I'm not supposed to talk about on the internet. I don't know exactly. But yeah, but it's a seminary, evangelical seminary. A lot more theological variety than what I'm used to at Westminster. So it's a little broader than Westminster is. But it's a magnificent school. And I guess I'd say that the purpose of the school is a very mission-oriented school. Every school in the universe says that, but Torch really means it. It was founded with one of its principal aims is to educate Koreans to go to the majority world, and they even the seminary invests a lot of energy into bringing students in from the majority world, educating them, and sending them back to pastor churches and start seminaries and things like that in relatively unreached places. So. The result for me is a very exciting classroom context with students from, you know, all over Asia, East Asia, Central Asia, and all of them to a person are really excited about doing ministry, and they have exciting stories about where they've been and what they hope to do. So I've enjoyed every minute of my time at the school so far, and there hasn't been that many minutes. The semester only started a couple weeks ago, but I'm really loving it. And a student asked me today at lunch if I've had to adjust my teaching at all since coming to Torch. And I had to think about it a little bit. It was an interesting question, but the one thing I told him was that Torch students seem to have much less patience for theological abstraction than is kind of my habit. They really want to know how does this affect Christian living, Christian thinking, how do we do ministry, in other words, link this to the efficacy of the doctrine. They want to see it happen. That I think has forced me to make a conscious step into the ministry world as I'm teaching and as we're going through, you know, some of the nuts and bolts of systematic theology. I really welcome that, and it just makes for a really exciting classroom environment. So I'm really grateful to be here, having the time of my life, and trying to get used to living in Korea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But on today's topic, It's a we're doing a Reform Media Review, and the title that we want to explore today, and I'm sure it's going to get into the topic as a whole and some peripheral topics too. It's a title called God and Necessity by Brian Leftow, and it's from Oxford University Press, and it came out actually in 2012. So you might be asking, okay, why are we doing a 2012 title in 2015? Well, part of the reason is because the book's length and the time it took really for people to digest the book and responses for the book. So, for example, in Faith and Philosophy, that journal, there's been an article coming out about the book every year since then. So there was an article in 2013 on the book by Chris Tweed. There was a review of the book by William Lane Craig that same year in 2013 in Faith and Philosophy. Last year, a philosophy professor named Jeff Speaks interacted with Leftow's work, and he talks about perfect being theology. And then in the recent issue of Faith and Philosophy, Brian Leftow responds to a lot of these comments and critiques and criticisms. And so it's been a title that if you're interested in philosophy of religion, in analytic philosophy, in analytic theology, really, and the relationship of God to abstract objects, which is something we talked about, I talked about last time in the Reform Media Review that I did on Paul Gould's volume that specifically addresses that, and William Lane Craig contributes to that as well. So the topic is ongoing. So that's one of the reasons why I wanted to take a look at it. Like I said, it is a pretty massive tome and it's thick. And the other reason that I wanted to address it is because Nate actually had, Dr. Shannon, has a review coming out in the Westminster Journal on the book. And so he's interacted with it a little bit. And should also mention Brian Leftow is a professor of philosophy of religion at Oxford over in England. So it's an important topic for its field. So it's not going to touch on all theological topics and interests. So if you find yourself kind of outside the interests of the philosophy world, I completely understand. That's what this is going to be. So just kind of a fair warning there. But Nate, why don't I just begin by asking, you know, why did you take up this volume and explore it and actually want to write a review in the Westminster Journal? And can you talk a little bit about what you're going for in the review?
Okay, yeah. I was initially interested in the text. Let me add, though, Jared, that one of the reasons it took us so long to get around to reviewing this book is because you and I couldn't put together a half-hour appointment for the last year and a half or something.
Also true.
We kept missing each other. Actually, I kept bailing out over and over. But anyway, yeah, actually my interest in the issue that Leftow addresses started a couple of years ago when I read James Anderson and Greg Welty's article, Lord of Non-Contradiction, and that was a exciting article. It was an exciting read for me because it was guys, you know, those two guys, you know, we can say kind of from our own theological world, Anderson being from RTS, treating the nature, the question of the relationship between God and logic. And that question is, it's kind of obscure, maybe interesting only to philosophers, but the reason I think it's so crucial for us to think about as theologians is because it lies way in the depths of questions about theological method and how it is, how it is that we can relate our theological predication to the laws of logic. To what sort of laws do we have to bow when we talk about God? Those kinds of things. In the tension between natural and revealed theology, and is there a gray area? If there's a gray area, those kinds of questions, basically theological method, prolegomena issues. And, at the time and still, I'm kind of wrestling with the relationship between revealed theology and Thomism, the doctrine of simplicity, all of these questions. Of course, will outlast me, so, obviously. But I was surprised and super pleasantly surprised to see this book come out called God and Necessity, because I just kept thinking, God and Necessity, that's the issue. God and logical necessity or metaphysical necessity. And I was kind of walking around thinking about, wow, man, I need some clarity on God and necessity. So this book came out, and I thought, wow, this is kind of the masterpiece. It's got to be, you know. Actually, Lefdow's title is The Nullah Professor of the Philosophy of the Christian Religion. You know, so it's sort of like, if you want a guy to write on this topic, it's Lefdow. He's written a lot on Thomas, but I don't think we should call him a Thomist. He's just got his own character. He has truckloads of courage and conviction, but he's very creative, and you can... You know when you're reading Lefdow, but you never know what he's going to say next, that kind of thing. So it's a really exciting read, and it was a topic that I was just really fired up about. So what I'm going for in the review, and the reason I wrote it for Westminster Journal, was that I was, I guess in a sense, autobiographical. What I was trying to do was build a bridge between this philosophical discussion, or theological-philosophical discussion, and the concerns that we share as Reformed theologians. Which are, you know, where we distinguish ourselves, I think, principally are what we say in terms of prolegomena, doctrine of Scripture, as those things relate to redemptive history and those issues. So really what I wanted to kind of do in the review, which is what I attempt, is to explain the question, what's the problem, what's Lefdow's formulation of the problem, how does he deal with it, and then to turn around and discuss the problem and Lefdow's proposal in theological terms and evaluate it from the point of view of Reformed theology.
Right.
So, yeah, so that's kind of what I was after, and that's where my interest in the text came from.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's good. Lefdow explains that one of the things that he wants to do when he's summarizing his project, he says he wants to provide a metaphysic of modality. So he's getting into, obviously, necessity and possibility. He gets into truth making. He gets into God's nature, you know, ideas like simplicity, as you said. If we can speak generally, I'm trying to figure out the best way to phrase this, because as I'm trying to formulate this question, I would say the book, it's 575 pages, and the number of topics that it includes is pretty vast and sometimes can be overwhelming because partially because of just its structure, its length, but also because of its logical structure, I guess, or literary structure is not quite the right word for it, but its flow, speaking very generally, maybe I wasn't picking up on it, but it didn't have quite as much of, I thought, a streamlined flow as you might read in other works. Or maybe I just wasn't picking up on something that I should have been picking up on. But all that is to say that I think the length of it and also just the amount of topics that it touches lends itself to kind of a disparate feel at times if you don't have all the arguments in your head cumulatively as you read through it. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was going to say, I think that's right. I think he's got a clear and well-defined mission, but a couple of things happen along the way. One thing, and this is pointed out by a number of reviewers, his argumentation is exhausting. It's a war of attrition, and he offers argument after argument after argument for each point and sub-point and sub-sub-point, and that is both exhausting and disorienting. And I think, especially for me as a more theologically trained reader, often the text sort of diverts into highly specialized discussions about any of the topics you named about how what a truth maker is and how truth makers work. All kinds of obscure topics in the philosophy of modality. And even though I'd done a little bit of some reading for, you know, a couple of years before I got into the text, there were numerous places where I felt completely sort of not allowed to play in the reindeer game. There was just no hope for me in several spots. And so in that sense, it is difficult to follow just the text as a whole for the average reader. And I say that in the review, I think this is going to serve most of all the most sort of seasoned expert, and I think even for the specialist, there's just plenty to interact with between the covers here. You know, over 500 pages worth of argumentation. So that also presented kind of a challenge, you know, because I wanted to get at the core argument and then evaluate it theologically. So that was kind of a lot of archaeology we had to do, and a lot of digging through the parlance and the Leftowian prose, you know.
Yeah, that's right. And I should also mention that in the beginning pages, Leftow is self-aware of what he's doing. He mentions that he hopes that this book, his own book, will be read by theologians, obviously, as well as philosophers. But he also explicitly mentions that they're going to have a difficult time with some of this stuff, just because the crossover field between theology and philosophy, there is crossover between those two fields, but it's going to be much more heavily weighted on the philosophical technicalities than things that you would expect in the theology field. So that I think everything you said is right.
Yeah, in terms of the sort of crossover between philosophy and theology, I had a number of thoughts in terms of, you know, about this book relative to that question. And I think that what I really appreciate in general, often, not always, but in general about analytic philosophy sort of dipping into theology or analytic theology, whatever that is, these guys tend to have the instincts, the courage, I don't know, the personality to push for a precision that theologians often neglect or don't achieve.
Yeah.
And I think that's really helpful. You know, I don't know, it seems like on one day I'll read this text and think, wow, Leftow has achieved some serious precision here, and he's been able to isolate the question and offer something new. Other days I read it and I think, wow, these are analytic philosophers talking to each other, and it's just noise. So I guess I go back and forth, but I think a text like this, even if you think it doesn't achieve anything theologically, it does force us to think in more precise categories and to be more precise with our language, and I think that can be helpful for theologians. Go ahead.
No, I was just agreeing, and maybe just piggybacking on that. So sorry to interrupt, but also, again, we don't want to provide a summary of every point or even, you know, tons of points here. We're just trying to give you an overall flavor of the book. Well, of course, we're going to get into some of the topics, but on that topic of the overall flavor of the book, I appreciate it. He also indicates in the beginning, I don't have the direct quote in front of me, but it's something like, you know, he has this existential moment that's kind of revealed in the book where he says something like, I get the feeling that we're just kind of making stuff up. And he's being facetious there, of course. Otherwise, he wouldn't spend 500.
I think he's being facetious, you know what? Yeah, right. That's at the beginning of a giant tech. I hear, you know, you interrupted me, so I'm
yeah, go for it.
But yeah, I love that quote too. And here it is. It's from page 11 and 12. I'll just read it. So he says here, he says, "Perfect being theology is inevitably speculative. I give many perfect being arguments. As I give them, I have a nagging fear that I'm just making stuff up." I loved that when I read it, and I just thought, this is what you read Leftow for, these kind of candid, you know, jabs to the chin. And I just really appreciate that, and I've quoted it in numerous things that I've written since then, just because Leftow said it, so it's got to be true, you know.
Yeah.
No, it's just great that he is really self-aware, you know, in terms of like, well, we're going out on a limb here. We're at the outer reaches of our theological knowledge and our theological categories. And he says, you know, I'm about to write a 600-page book. Maybe I'm just blowing hot air, you know?
Right. Yeah, you got to appreciate the refreshing honesty that comes from it. There's another, I don't know, it's somewhere around that same quote that you're reading, but just a compliment to what you just said. He says something like, you know, it, sometimes it feels like we're just showing each other the insides of our own concepts. He has a very nice literary metaphorical way of putting things at times. And he is, he can be so precise on concepts and ideas that you can, I think anyone who has an inclination towards high theological concepts is going to gain something from reading Lefthow in this particular book, because there are just, and you mentioned this in your review, that there are moments where you're just going, that is probably the best way to put whatever concept you just described. So I forget what you said. I don't have the direct quote in front of me, but you know, you mentioned the somewhat laborious nature of some of the arguments and the technicalities, but you also say that the reader is rewarded at times because of the very things that I mentioned. So I think that was a helpful balance that you indicated.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's there. I think that's there. And other reviewers have noted, there's a, let me quote from William Lane Craig in terms of Lefthow's prose. He says, "Unfortunately, the book is somewhat hamstrung by Lefthow's inelegant writing style." So it's, yeah, it's pretty slamming, but so I think there's a balance. You get some statement. There were some statements in the text that I stared at endlessly, just trying to figure out whether there was really anything there to understand, or maybe it was a typo or something. But other times he just strikes the right note, and you come away with a real gem. So
yeah, that's totally true. Okay. Well, as far as the content of the book goes, again, you know, we don't want to go into every single argument, but I do want to give the listener just kind of a teaser of what to expect. We mentioned some of the ideas, some of the theological concepts, some of the philosophical concepts. Maybe one way of summarizing it, again, he's trying to provide a metaphysic of modality. One way of summarizing it is he's trying to take very seriously the doctrine of ex nihilo, God creating ex nihilo. And it's similar, actually, to what Craig is trying to do in his article in the Gould volume that I mentioned earlier. But do you want to comment at all on some particulars of the book that might get listeners interested in what they can expect?
Sure. Yeah, so Lefthow restates in his own way, his own very winsome way, the problem of abstract objects. So he wants to talk about all modality. He wants to talk about possibility and necessity and everything. But he begins with the problem of necessary truths. And he says basically, and you can really appreciate this from just kind of an ordinary theological approach, but he says that necessary truths pose a problem for the claim that God is ultimate, and everyone can agree with that. And I like that about Lefthow. He says something simple, and you agree, and he walks you into the detail, I think, step by step, at least in his statement of the problem he does. There's a lot of detail to it. There are different ways to articulate the ultimacy of God. He's got two of them. He says, first in duration. Before all else existed, God existed alone, or God and only God did not begin to exist. Something like that. Then he also has another way to articulate divine ultimacy. For all X, if X is not God, a part or aspect or attribute of God, God makes the creating ex nihilo sort of causal contribution to X's existence as long as X exists. So I hope all the listeners were able to type that out. And caught all the details. But the point is that we Christians, we readers of the Bible, confess and believe under the teaching of Scripture that God is ultimate, right? But then we have a problem because he says, because there are things which are necessarily true. And it's generally agreed that the propositions or statements which are necessarily true, he says, have an ontology, which means that they exist. So propositions exist. And the proposition that to which a kind of a, you know, like a 7 + 5 + 7 = 12, this proposition or statement points to a proposition that exists necessarily. So a necessarily true proposition must also exist necessarily, right? And so then we have this problem of propositions that are necessarily true, that exist necessarily, and so they compete sort of ontologically with God. They claim sort of an ontological equality with God.
Part of what he's going to do there, too, is make a finer distinction between an explanation for something's existence and something being necessarily true, that oftentimes those things are conflated. So some philosophers will think, okay, well, if 5 plus 7 equals 12 is necessarily true, then the reason it exists is because it's necessarily true. He's going to say, well, no pun intended, not necessarily, that there's something else going on behind that that accounts for its quote-unquote existence, however you believe propositions to exist. And so he's going to explain really why there's a difference in explanation for those kinds of more abstract necessary truths.
Yeah, good catch. That was a really helpful distinction that he makes early in the text. And here's a quote from page 27. He says, this is my language. I say the fact that 5 plus 7 equals 12 is absolutely necessary or absolutely true or necessarily true just means that there is no explanation for its being true, right? And we agree about that. And then Liftow says, okay, so if a question should not arise, meaning question about why 5 plus 7 equals 12 is true, Liftow says it has no correct answer. A fortiori, it has none invoking God. End quote. Consequently, and here's Liftow again, God is not the only underived reality. And what does not somehow derive from God is a given for God. He does not make it or shape it. He finds it and must work within the bounds it sets. So there's the threat that, you know, supposedly necessarily true propositions pose to God sort of ontologically. But he points out that it's such a great distinction because he's going to go on to say that God must be the truth maker for necessarily true propositions. If that doesn't hold him to saying that God is the explanation, so he can still say that a necessarily true proposition is without an explanation for its being true. But then he can also say, but that doesn't mean that the necessarily true proposition doesn't need a truth maker, right?
Right.
So that way he's going to say, okay, we have necessarily true propositions. They exist necessarily. But I want to still hold to my biblical belief that God is uniquely ultimate, right? And so his move then is he's going to say he proposes and then defends the claim that God or something in God or something God does is the truth maker for all necessarily true propositions.
Right. Yeah. And the background knowledge to this, again, I'll try to summarize as briefly as I can. But what he's assuming here is, again, kind of that classic problem of God and abstract objects, which finds its locus really in God's power and God's knowledge, that there's somewhat of at least seeming paradox there where if God has from eternity before anything was created the power to, let's say, create a dog, then that proposition, you know, the dogginess or whatever it is, things that are involved with God creating a dog actually in reality, that then becomes, because he knows those things, somewhat coexistent with God, even though they're not God, those abstract objects, those propositions, whatever they are, however you describe them. So then you have this paradox of saying, well, God, of course, we affirm can do anything, but how do we articulate that in the light of wanting to also maintain that God really does create things ex nihilo, including, as Liftow wants to maintain, those abstract objects as well, that they're not just coexistent with them. So that's setting up the problem. He doesn't exactly go into all that background, but that's what he's coming to the table with in this book.
When you have God is able to create dogs, or God creates dogs, that assumes that in some way the possibility to create dogs, you know, possible, you know, dogs being possible, mm-hmm. or dogness exists alongside of God's eternal nature being, you know, his ability to create things, namely dogness. And so you end up, and then this comes up in Liftow's text when he discusses, so he's going through various ways to handle the relationship between God and necessary objects or necessarily true proposition. And he talks about deity theories, which are theories that try to explain, that try to get at the problem from by explaining that by associating these things with the nature of God, instead of we're gonna go back and forth between God's nature and His will.
Yeah.
And so he says that a number of theories have tried to explain these things in terms of the divine nature. In other words, that modality derives from the divine nature. And hear this sometimes this way, and you just brought it up, that, well, God doesn't necessarily create, but He creates eternally. That to me is really confusing, and I'm not even sure what it means.
That's big.
Because it kind of is, because I think often when that's said, someone says, well, God doesn't create essentially. He's not essentially creator. But because He creates eternally, then we can't really talk about Him not creating. And then, it's kind of, like you said, it's bait, it's swish and bait, and all of a sudden, then you're talking about there's no possible world in which God doesn't create.
Right.
We don't want to go that way. But Lefdow's critique, which is fairly predictable, but he says it in a Lefdow way, is just that deity theories, which tie modality to the divine nature, then tie the divine nature to created things. Here he says it this way. He said, deity's being as it is, makes true all necessary truth about created things. He uses an example about water. What it is to be water, what is necessary to be water, how water can change, what water can do, and so on. End quote. The implication is that, he says, the nature of water is in some way the nature of God. So, and here's his punchline. He says, quote, surely deleting a chemical property from logical space should not affect whether God exists.
Right. Yeah. He wants to, yeah, there's a separation, or maybe it, better said, another distinction that he wants to do, which is, if you think about, okay, God creating possibility, what he wants to do is make a distinction between the power of God to create, to be creative, whatever that means, whatever that can mean, and then the specific index for, let's even say just like the actual world, let's just say dogs or whatever, that he wants to separate those two things and say, well, of course God has the power to do anything that he wants, but you don't necessarily have to include a specific index to that power for us to still be orthodox and affirm God's omnipotence. And I think whether or not someone buys that argument, I still think it is a it's an argument that makes a good distinction, whether we again buy that distinction or not. That's a helpful way of separating a couple concepts that are baked into that whole topic.
Yeah, I think that is really helpful. That was one of my favorite parts of the book, when he works very hard, and as maybe you're indicating, I don't know how successful he is, but he works very hard to separate God's power and freedom from actual indices. In other words, we don't want to tie God's ability to created things to intelligible things, to logical things, because what ends up happening is that it's a two-way street, right? And then our theology ends up stuck in the created order, stuck in the logical order, and we can invent God from nothing, by the sheer power of our own concepts and experience. That's a couple steps down the road, but that's the idea, and that's his critique. That God gets sort of lassoed by created modality, so that's really helpful. Right. He wants to put a defensive piece there in between God's ability, between divine powers and the objects of those powers.
Right. Right.
Yes, yeah, so that's really helpful.
Yeah, I liked that move actually.
So that's one thing I really appreciated, just that he wanted to sever the divine nature from what is not God. You got to appreciate that. And it also seemed that as he worked through this, he talked about what God has it in him to do, which is a way of talking about divine power without tying it to things. And then he talked about the natural implication then is to say that, which Lefdahl says, that God can give himself powers, you know, which of course is kind of alarming because it sounds like mm-hmm. God is building his own being.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't think that's what Lefdahl is doing, and I don't think that's sort of necessarily implied by how he's putting things. I think all that he's really saying is that God creates from nothing, right? And when he creates from nothing, he, by his own sort of covenanting commitment, is bound to the nature of things. But it's a self-limiting, self-limiting of God. And I think that that's a very biblical way to look at providence, you know, so that God creates from nothing and that he rests on the seventh day, and that from that point on, it's by the power of his word and his faithfulness that nature proceeds the way it does, that we can trust nature, that apple trees grow apples, that they continue to do that. God in himself is not bound to any created thing, but he has promised that creation will continue to operate according to the nature that he gave it, right? And you know, until the return of Christ. But so I think that I sort of felt like there was so much of value in the text that we can appreciate from that point of view. And here's the last thing I'll say that I really thought that I hope Lefdahl was doing, because I think this is what he's doing. I really appreciate it. It seemed that he wanted to say that for there to be creative modality and for us to be able to preserve the ultimacy of God, you know, ontologically, the unique ontological ultimacy of God, there must be divine non-necessity. In other words, that mm-hmm. God must move and voluntarily, non-necessarily create things, create not God, you know, make a world separate from himself. And honestly, I think that at the bottom of our theological method, the question of whether God moves or not moves is of explosive importance, and, you know, in terms of where we go in our theology proper. So if I took away one thing from this text, it's that based on our biblical confession of the unique ontological ultimacy of God, in order to explain created modality, there must be divine non-necessity. God did not have to move, but he did. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's priceless.
I took away the same thing, and again, not to belabor the point, but that point is different from saying that God had the freedom to just simply actualize or not actualize, you know, pre-existing concepts or possibilities or something. So it's I think that affirms something about theology proper that, at least on a first glance, that sounds a little bit more orthodox and biblical than maybe other options. So yeah, I hear
yeah,
you.
I think that's right. Yeah.
We're looking forward to reading the review when it comes on the Westminster Journal. Do you have an idea of which issue that'll be out in?
I think it's going to be the spring. Yep, the probably soon to be released issue. So I haven't been in touch with WTJ since I left the Western Hemisphere, so I'm not sure exactly when it'll come out, but it should be spring 2015.
Okay, good. So coming up here in the next couple months, look for that. And also look for, we will probably schedule at some point a Philosophy for Theologians episode on your upcoming book that's really going to be revised from your dissertation, right? And I think you said that Nicholas Walterstorff has agreed to write the foreword. Can you tell us just a quick preview on that piece?
He did, yeah. Walterstorff wrote the foreword, for which I'm very, very grateful. So my dissertation will come out in book form maybe May. They told me May, could be June, I think.
Okay.
But anyway, the topic is Walter Sorge's theory of rationality, his situated theory of rationality. And basically what I try to do is tie this situated rationality with a kind of Kuyperian common grace ethic. We all know and appreciate Walter Sorge's eclectic literature. He's written on so many different topics. What I found interesting was that there's very little thought in terms of the organic connection. You know, do any of his work on art relate to any of his other bodies of work? And so I was specifically interested in kind of broadly epistemological questions and how those relate to his theological background, being, you know, in many ways from the same tradition we are, Dutch Reformed. So that was the question I went in wanting to answer. Does Walter Sorge's work in epistemology in any way relate to his Dutch Reformed theological background? And I ended up arguing that his theory of situated rationality is a, you know, I'll call it this and then leave everyone wondering, is a shalom doxastic ethic. So that's the thesis of my dissertation.
Interesting. Well, that should be a good discussion for sure. So we'll look for that too. But thanks for coming on and talking about the topic, the book, your journal article. There's a lot to think about. As I said, this book is quite lengthy. It's quite complex. It's quite expensive. But for those who are interested in the general topic, this is definitely a necessary piece to add to your library, your thought on the matter. There's a lot here to digest. So we'll see you next time on Reform Media Review. Thanks for joining us.